Okay, you're going to find what some of the ancient mystery schools were all about when we come back with Tricia McKinnon on Coast to Coast AM, so stand by. Tricia McKinnon is our guest tonight as we talk about her work, Jesus, the Explosive Story, the Lost 30 Years, and the Ancient Mystery Religions as well. This, tell me about your research now, Tricia. How did you, first of all, go around accumulating and investigating?
Okay. Well, that's a really great question, George. As I told you, like many of us, I very much was on a search for truth at an early age. The Viragi masters were very powerful in that, and I still continually, you know, will see them even to this day. But they were my first teachers, and then I had, of course, the whole process of the whole UFO forum and many, many years of study and research with that. And I wound up having these very powerful masters from the Egyptian mystery schools make contact with me on the inner, which is to say in the lucid dream state, you know, where it's mm-hmm. as real as the physical world. And I know you know a lot about lucid dreaming. When I was about 27, and they invited me to study with them, and it took me about 3 years to say yes. I knew that I would because of the power of the encounter, but I, you know, I was already very deeply into other levels of study at that point, and the Viragi had been very powerful. So all through this, and then, you know, my 30s, I wound up becoming involved in the goddess teachings and the divine feminine, and those are, of course, worldwide in many cultures. So I had the Far East, the Middle East, the Native American twisted hair, the Egyptian, and I began to find all these, let's say, similarities, if you will, mm-hmm. between these. And I began to understand that there was some kind of a connection. And, you know, I was writing a book. I've written one other book, Dialogues with the Angels, which is a fabulous, magical, wonderful book about, you know, when I was young and how the angels and divas and spirits came, and then when the Viragi came and their teachings and the masters, and then this very powerful group of beings called the Council of Nine that are like the nine primordial wave form energies that penetrate the universe. Well, the Viragi used to call them the nine silent ones. They can be anywhere and they can be everywhere. And so they became my teachers probably in my early 30s. And, you know, on the outside world, I was a commercial advertising photographer, art director, very successful.
Was it easy to separate the two for you?
Well, I had my outer life, which was advertising, marketing, photography, all that. And I had my inner life, which was, you know, meditation and really working to develop these clairvoyant skills and gifts and abilities. And I didn't let people in my, let's say, my straight Clark Kent world necessarily yeah. know about my other world.
Why?
Well, I live in the South, and at that time, the South was far more conservative. I think today, like you found in San Diego, we have, you know, many wonderful, amazing people, and that number is growing all the time all over the world. And here in the South, too, you know, we have the wonderful Unity churches and churches of religious science and metaphysical bookstores and centers, and they're just some very cool, tuned-in people now all the way around. But at that time, it was a lot more conservative,
okay.
especially in the Bible Belt.
So you're concerned about the ridicule, maybe, things like that?
Well, I mean, I think that I believe that often people were sent to me as clients that had other reasons. Like, for example, when I was about 30, 31, I was engaged to the vice president of MCA Records over in England,
okay.
the head of A&R.
Yeah.
And I had this very powerful experience I speak about in my first book where this angel appeared to me in Stonehenge and unsealed the Akashic Records. And with that, I found that I could look at the soul records of anybody that I met and track them through time. And when I first started reading for people, I went back 3,000-5,000 years in their history. And then I made a leap to where I was going back to these ancient civilizations like Atlantis and Lemuria. And it was a whole other feel. And then I began to track my soul, the soul I was reading for, like pulling a thread up through the third dimension into the fourth. I kept always asking, well, wait a minute, where was the soul before that? Where was the soul before that lifetime? Where did they come from before that? I was very interested in knowing what the source was.
All right, well, these missing years, because that is a major thrust of your work.
In fact, the missing years of Jesus, this is, I think he was born as a being who had his own profound and deep wisdom, and he was, I believe, the incarnation of that third level that the mystery schools believed in, which was the solar sun, or the S-U-N, or the S-O-N, the Son of God.
At what point did he realize who he was? When he was a child, or much later in life?
Well, you know, I think that he was probably told. There was a lot of mythos, as you remember, about, you know, the great Lion of Judah and the coming of this Messiah and so forth. But I think that he went inward with this information rather than going outward. And there were, as you may know, many, let's say, zealots at that time who claimed to be various levels of the Messiah. And it was more about freeing the Hebrew community from the tyranny of the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and also the military might of Rome. But Jesus's travels, which I talk about in the book at great depth, he studied with six different chapters of the Great White Brotherhood, the Essenes, the Druids, the Therapeutae in Egypt, the Mithran Persians, and Zoroastrian Persians.
And the Essenes are the ones that we claim put the Dead Sea Scrolls together, right?
Yeah, they had nine communities throughout what we would think of as Palestine or Israel. Actually, it was the southern kingdom was Judea, and the northern was Galilee, which had once been the home to a lot of Gentiles, mm-hmm. until the Maccabees kind of forced them to conform about 100 B.C. So we had a lot of things going on at that time. But if you think about it, Jesus was surrounded by the mystery schools everywhere. To the south was Egypt, where, you know, Abraham had gone, where Joseph of the coat of many colors had gone, where many other, let us say, Jewish tribal patriarchs had a deep level of association with the mysteries. Moses, of course, a master initiate who studied in the temples of Heliopolis the second.
Okay, but when you say he was told who he was, basically.
Well, who
told him?
Well, of course, the stories of the Annunciation, where the angel appears to Mary, and there's this whole prophecy, and Joseph, of course, Joseph the dad, mm-hmm. is having to deal with the fact that his 15-year-old young wife that he wasn't even sure he wanted to take, because he already had five children and was older. He was probably, I don't know, could have been in his 50s. We don't know exactly how old, but we know.
Well, that's not too old. Come on now.
right. But if you were marrying a 15-year-old,
well,
that'd be a big deal.
That's a big deal.
That's a big age gap.
Yeah, that's
there.
Jail time.
Yes, that's jail bait. So back to the mysteries, there are many different, one of the things, that the book's organized basically in six sections. The first section, two chapters where I talk about the mysteries and how they taught, and how they taught their mysteries on three levels, and how they taught through Hermetics. And then we begin the story.
Now, when you say they taught, who's they?
The sages, the adepts, the masters who were involved in transmitting this deeper esoteric knowledge to initiates.
All right. Okay. Now, was that pre or post-Jesus?
The mystery schools had been in full bloom some 4,000 years before Jesus was born, and some 400 years after. And when I say he was surrounded, you had the Eleusinian mysteries in Greece. You had the Egyptian mysteries in Egypt. You had the Buddhist who had already come into Egypt, for example, and into England.
Were they all similar, their stories, their mysteries?
Somewhat, yes. For example, almost all of the chapters of the Great White Brotherhood, or the Melchizedek Order, as it's referred to in the Old Testament, had three levels of initiation. The first level was what they call the lesser mysteries, and they were about the divine feminine. And it's not because the female is lesser than the male, it's because they were foundational. If you didn't get that piece, you couldn't understand the rest. So they believed very much in the awe and wonder of the divine as it expressed through the intelligence of nature. So they taught astronomy, they taught botany and herbs and healing.
They were the scientists of the era.
They were the scientists of the era. They taught physics, and they taught metaphysics. And they taught both the mastery of the left side of the brain and the right side of the brain. And they believed that by beginning to activate, let's say, your kundalini or your chi or life force energy and moving it up the spine in a very specific yoga or way of breathing, that you would encounter places within your emotional field, let's say, where you were blocked. And of course, you'd have to do the work of doing house cleaning and getting rid of whatever that block was. But eventually, if you cleared enough of your own stuff, you could become a vessel for greater and greater levels of light or enlightenment. And eventually, you activated this place between your left and right hemispheres where the corpus callosum is. And when you did this, you balanced the male and the female, and you could activate your clairvoyance, your inner sight. And this, they believed, by developing these inner faculties, it was the beginning of one's ability to directly experience those invisible dimensions you were speaking about earlier.
All right. Now, this is where it really becomes a little investigative and fascinating at the same time. So these schools are around 4,000 years before, 400 years after.
Indeed.
This individual shows up on the scene. And, that's just a fact. It's a given. He's here. At about what age does he just disappear?
Well, you know, in the Bible, the New Testament, Gospels, basically we get the story of the Nativity, the story where the magical hero is born. Then we know that they leave for Egypt. Then we don't hear anything else till they're back in Judea, and they have to come down from Galilee when he's about 12 for kind of the equivalent of the bar mitzvah.
Okay.
This is something that was demanded of all 12, 13-year-olds to sort of be sure that they were being taught in the Jewish scripture. The temple demanded it with the Pharisees and Sadducees. And then after that, nothing.
Was he being written about or observed up until 12? I mean, was he like the talk of the moment?
Well, at the time that the whole Star of Bethlehem happened, you know, in my book, I wound up getting access to some of the 560,000 documents hidden in the Vatican.
And how many?
Well, I can just tell you, in the late 1800s, there were 560,000 documents, and I'm sure there are a lot more than that now.
All right.
But I wound up getting access in the course of writing this book to some very phenomenal historical documents. And among them were Vatican, about 11 very important, precious, key Vatican documents from that time. One of them was a reporter that had been hired by the Sanhedrin Council after the whole Star of Bethlehem incident.
So they knew about that?
Yeah, okay. They did. To go and interview the high priest of Bethlehem, who was a guy called Melchor. And he had lived in Antioch, and his family had been very, you know, religious and so forth. And he was very, very excited because it sounded like he was more of a mystic, and he interpreted. They talk about what actually happened. This reporter actually interviewed the shepherds, too.
And about what time period are we talking about?
This is right at Jesus' birth. And
okay.
So they sent somebody out, like, you know, within a week or 2 weeks or a month, you know, very close to the time that it was all happening. And you know how in the New Testament we're just given like maybe a inch of writing about all this stuff?
Yeah.
I had two pages.
These were authentic writings? Or
yes.
This is fantastic.
It is fantastic. And what?
And so this reporter that the Sanhedrin sent was trying to find out who this little kid was?
Yeah, his name was Jonathan, and exactly, that's exactly why he was trying to find out what it was. And the priest said that the light came down over the whole city. It was huge, and it was moving and sparkling. And they thought the gods were coming down. They thought maybe Rome was on fire. They thought it was the end of the world. What?
This is amazing.
Yes, it's incredible. That's just one of about 11 phenomenal documents just from that source.
Does that make it, do you think we're talking about some kind of craft that was spotlighting the area?
I do. In fact, the shepherds say that what happened is an extraordinary passage, actually, and I include quite a bit of it in my book, but they say that there was this light that came down and was coming in waves around them, and that this music, incredible sounding music, started playing. Now, they didn't actually see physical angels, the shepherds, but they heard these voices, like voices on high or something.
Well, and could these angels have been ETs?
It is quite possible. Now, this is, of course, gets into the whole conversation about the multidimensional level of reality.
Right.
Were they physical people, you know, like the Anunnaki, or were they, let's say, fourth or fifth or sixth dimensional beings?
And how do we know, Tricia, that the craft, assuming it was one, wasn't there as a witness to what was going on?
Well, this is absolutely true, too. And, you know, in the UFO phenomena, I mean, there are some extraordinary people who know, I mean, they work very closely with the government, who have said that, you know, 70-80% of the phenomena is multidimensional, and you can't really comprehend it if you think it's all just metallurgical samples, you know, because sometimes these craft act in ways that we just don't even know how to understand. They seem to go through walls. Okay, invisible, you could figure a cloaking device, but something that literally can go through solid materiality, what the heck is that?
Well, let's make an assumption, one of two things. Either Jesus was an ET, right, and they beamed him down, or like you said, his soul, or two, this was a bona fide craft from some other planetary system, and they knew about this incredible event. Maybe it had happened on their planet, and they were going to monitor it.
Yeah, the thing is, it's very interesting. This is becomes, you know, again, all this is within the realm of the mysteries. You know, it's a mystery, and mysteries are something that you must feel with your heart and with your soul and with your spirit.
And this does not negate belief in God. We're not even talking about that, right?
No, and you know, when I talk about that, a scene that saw the four lights,
yes,
they came from four directions. And what's interesting is there were four wise men, not three, but one of them did not make it. And they came from north, south, east, and west. And we know from Herod's report, which I have a letter that's like, you know, a page long for him. He said when the three wise men showed up, he described them as three fantastically dressed men appeared at my court. Well, I mean, you know, I'm sure they were dressing pretty good in Jerusalem. So what did he mean, fantastically dressed?
Yeah.
But he said one was from Egypt. So we know one was from Egypt.
And I assume one was from Persia at the time.
I think one was from Persia. I think that would have probably been...
Maybe Greece also?
Possibly Greece, could be India. And also, I think the one, my sense is that the one that didn't make it was from the Druids.
When we come back, Tricia, let's talk more about these missing 30 years. I want your take with your research on just where you think he went. We'll be back. Well, you better stay a little bit longer. We've got a whole program for you with Tricia McCannon as we talk about the missing 30 years of Jesus and the ancient mystery religions and schools. On our next Coast to Coast program, Norio Hayakawa joins us. We're going to be talking about Project Bluebeam, that false flag of ETs. It's a fantastic story. But we'll be back with more with Tricia next hour, phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. So, Tricia, around 12, you say Jesus just takes off with his family, I assume. Where do they go? Where did you go? Well, let's see.
There she is. You know, relentless brain.
Hello, Tricia?
Yes,
there
Trish.
You are. Okay, there are you.
Okay, did you think you lost me?
Yes.
Okay, no, I'm here.
Okay.
You know, one thing, if it's okay, I'd really like to tell people on my website, because I always get so absorbed by our conversation that I totally space it out every time. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. It's www.trishamcannonspeaks.com.
All right. So where did he go for 12 years?
Okay. Well, a lot more than 12 years, George. After the age of 12, you know, before, when his family went to Egypt when he was young, they were there probably for about 7 years. Arab sources say that they were in Egypt for that long. There are some traditional Christian sources that say maybe 4 or 5 years, but 7 years is, I think, more realistic, because we have reports of Jesus and his uncle, Joseph of Arimathea, and his mother, Mary, visiting in Britain when he was 7 years old. In fact, it's said that he wintered over several months there, and served as a kind of a shipwright on his uncle's ship.
Why did they go there?
Well, this is a very interesting part of the story, actually, that most people know nothing about. And it has to do with Mary. Mary and Joseph of Arimathea, their mother was Anna. And Anna was a Celtic princess. She was Celtic royalty from a line of the, let us say, most mystical priestess-like families in Britain, the Gwynissa line. And the Gwynissa line is where we get Merlin. Merlin, of course, came some 500 years later, but also the bard Taliesin, from which we know a lot of the Druid culture from his poetry and his writing. So this, the Gwynissa line was a very, very mystical, psychic, prophetess, prophet line. So on one side, Jesus had that lineage, and even today, the Catholic Church and many Protestant churches are dedicated to Anna in England and in France, because the story is that she fled from an abusive marriage and made her way through a particular travel down to the Essenes, and there she remarried an Essene man.
Now, were they trying to hide Jesus, or they were just going all over the place?
Well, Anna, of course, would have been two generations. Anna would have been Jesus's grandmother.
Okay.
Okay. So if you follow the lineage, you've got the mystical house of David with the line of Judah and that line of prophet kings on one side, and on the other, you have the mystical Celtic connections. And it's one of the reasons why Jesus returned to Britain three times in his life. He studied with them from around the age of 14 to 16. We have very strong reports of him studying with the Druids then, but he was so advanced that they pretty much said, okay, send him on to India.
Well, you know, there's always been talk that the royal family of England has his lineage. Is that possible?
I think it's very possible, and I think it's one of the reasons why the Knights of the Round Table and the quest for the Holy Grail and all of those things were so focused in the Glastonbury Avalon area. And there's a whole section of the book about the British mysteries, because in truth they were some of the most beautiful and profound hermetic teachings about the Tree of Life, the One World Tree, the One World Mountain, the One World Egg, the everlasting stream of that's connected to the ocean of love and mercy. And Avalon was the seat of these powerful mysteries, and at that time it was actually an island. Today it's known as Glastonbury, but at that time the sea, the Severn Sea and the River Brew, came in, and there were seven great islands that looked like an undulating dragon, a dragon's back. And Avalon was the eye of the dragon, if you will. It's actually what was known as the dragon's heart, and it's a place where the ley lines, the male and female energies that today we call the Mary and the Michael lines, they were known in Jesus's time as the dragon and the tiger lines.
All right, let's not wander too much here. Let's find out where he wandered.
Okay, yes. Okay, so he was in Britain, and then he went on to India. And he was in India for many years, and the stories of him in India are quite profound. There's a section of the book on India and Persia. It's said that he was actually initiated by the Brahmins, and then when he graduated from that, he began to travel through India and teach his own wisdom. And he was very democratic. He at that time, the caste system was very strong in India. And so the Brahmins had the spiritual teachings, and the nobility could hear them sometimes. And, you know, a few times a year, the merchants could hear them, and the farmers and peasants could only hear them once a year.
Was he developing a name for himself then?
He had about 5,000 followers very quickly. And in fact, so strong was his impact, because he taught to everyone. He believed that everyone had the right to whatever spiritual joy, light, love, and that they could, that they wanted to attain.
Was he performing miracles at the time?
He had become a really a powerful yogi. And we do have reports of miracles when he was crossing through Chaldea and Persia. When he was in India, I have no doubt that he did perform them. But what happened actually was there were assassins that were sent to kill him.
From?
It would definitely have been the ruling classes.
Okay.
Okay, they were afraid of an uprising, much as in, you know, Judea later on, you actually saw that whole thing.
So he was getting powerful.
He was getting powerful. He had a huge following. He was very loved. He was definitely outside the box, because he was a egalitarian or a Democrat or whatever we want to call it.
No radio, no TV, so it was all word of mouth, and it was probably all over the place, right?
It was all over the place because he taught everyone, people who, like I said, were never allowed to hear spiritual wisdom or scriptures, or if they heard it, they heard it once a year, and that's it.
Right.
So what happened then, I have two stories, and who knows which is true, but one is that the Magi appeared and warned him, and the other is that the farmers and peasants warned him, and he fled to Rajagira. And Rajagira is where the Buddha was enlightened beneath the Bodhi tree. And he lived in Rajagira for 6 years, and he knew the language of Pali, Pali, which is what all the Buddhist scriptures were written in. And he was accepted as the second Buddha that the first Buddha predicted would come some 500 years after him.
Now, what got him, Tricia, to come back to the Judea Galilee area, Palestine, at the time?
Well, I do think that he incarnated very deliberately in one of the densest places on the planet at that time. In order to try to break the chains, if you will, of the spiritual, moral, and military oppression, if you will, that was happening. And that, you know, most people don't know that there was a very huge hidden history with the Jewish people. As we know, you know, the history is that Moses brought these people out of Egypt about 1460 or so BC is what we currently believe. And then, you know, 700 years later, you have the dynasty of King David and then King Solomon. And then after King Solomon's son, everything falls. And the whole Jewish tribes were, there were 10 of them to the north in Samaria, and there were two of them in Judea. That's kind of the history. The Samaria fell around 700 and, I don't know, 68 or something like that. And then Judea was taken down about 560. And they were in captivity for 60 years with I think it was the Babylonians. And they weren't allowed to have physical temples at that time. So what happened was that the rabbis and priests sat around and sort of made up a lot of rules. And they created one of the books called the Midrash that had like 615 or 13 rules. And some of them were maybe useful, but some of them were very oppressive. And while I'm sure there was still that beautiful spiritual current within Judaism for a long time, when the Syrian invaders started coming in around 200 BC, a lot of the knowledgeable priests that had the real knowledge were killed, the Zadokite priests. In fact, they fled to Egypt, set up a fully functioning temple that passed down the wisdom of Moses. And because Judea was constantly being bombarded, people were being killed off, the temple was being taken over, you know, there was a whole break, and this gets into the teacher of righteousness and, you know, all this very complicated Jewish history that it took me a long time to really make out, but I looked at a lot of historical sources about it. But it seems like that's the point at which the Essenes, who were members of the Great White Brotherhood, about 150 BC, realized that the formal temple in Jerusalem was being taken over by people that really didn't know the esoteric teachings. And so they split off and began the community of Qumran.
Well, did somebody tell him, come back, or did he do this on his own?
You're talking about Jesus?
Well, that's what we're talking about.
What do you mean when you say come back?
To come back to the area that he was in.
No, I think he knew that this was his mission. I think he was very cognizant. You know, one of the descriptions of the great avatar is one who is able to be the master of masters and to be a universalist. And so he really traveled and was trained by these sages and these adepts and masters, many of whom knew he had been coming. In fact, five different groups had predicted his incarnating for over 500 years. The Celts, for example, they said that there had been two gods of previous eras, and that the god that was coming that would oversee our era would be called Yeshu.
Well, how old was he when he came back?
He came back about 20, probably 27, and he was in Palestine for two or three years. Then we have reports of him in Britain at the age of 30, which he probably went back to see the Druids from his time when he was 15 or 16, and maybe to actually have a little R&R, because I think he knew that he was about to begin the next section of his life, which was the Egyptian mysteries. And this is the only place where my book does not go along with traditional, in the gospel, we all think that Jesus started his ministry at 30 and died at 33. And that's because in the gospel of Luke says he appeared to be a man around 30. But if we remember, Luke didn't actually know Jesus. He and Paul came in after Jesus had died. So I'm sure Luke was doing the best he could to be a good historian, but he could have appeared to be 30 and not be 30 at all. And in fact, in the Gospel of John, I can't believe I'm quoting the Bible, but here we are. This is what happens when you write a book on these mysteries. In the Gospel of John, Jesus is talking to some Jews, and he says, before Abraham was, I am. And the Jews say, are you crazy, man? You're not yet 50. How can you have been alive back then? Well, you might say that to a 40-year-old, but you wouldn't say you're not 50 to a 30-year-old.
No, you wouldn't.
So, and John, of course, did know Jesus.
So why is the disparity in age between when they think he died and when you say he died?
Well, I think he probably did die between 33 and 35
AD. Well, that's not off too much.
No. 33 is the classically accepted one. But when you start doing his age, it's just a matter of math. We know, for example, that John the Baptist did not start baptizing until 15 years after Tiberius Caesar took the throne. Tiberius took the throne in 14 AD. So 14 plus 15 is 29. That's when John started. Now, we don't know if Jesus showed up 6 months later or a year later, but let's just say 30 AD. So when was Jesus born? Well, since Herod the Great was such a big part of the nativity story, and we know he died in April of 4 BC, and he issued that edict for the massacre of the innocent kids in Bethlehem to be killed, going back 2 years. Even if he had issued it virtually on his deathbed in January or February of 4 BC, that would have put Jesus being born at the very youngest date at 6 BC.
So when he came back, is that when he raised and put together his apostles and he started his big mission and push in that short period up until his death?
Yeah, but this is after 7 years in the temples of Egypt. Absolutely, he came back, and one of the things that I've realized in doing this profound research about the mysteries and the mystery schools and how Jesus played this out is that he was actually playing out these cosmic mysteries that had been hidden within the great mystery schools for thousands of years.
Well, no, what do you mean by that? Playing out these mysteries.
Well, he played them out on a world stage, and that was the whole life and death and crucifixion and resurrection. Because within the mystery schools, part of the process of activating people's left side of the brain and the right side of the brain, they had, you know, courses of study. They had all sorts of things that we think of in a university or school. But they also developed clairaudience, clairvoyance, clairsentience, healing, all the intuitive abilities, the spiritual gifts. And one of the things that they sought to give each initiate were direct experiences of out-of-body travel. And they did this through these great cosmic mystery dramas, where they took them down into caves or into underground temples, and they put them through basically near-death experiences.
Now, there was a guy named Lazarus that apparently was dead, and Jesus brought him back again. Is that true?
I personally believe that all the miracles that are attributed to him are true, and I believe this for many reasons. We know, just simply if you go over to the East and you read the histories of yogis, that people have been known to be invisible, walk through walls, heal people, raise the dead. Sai Baba has been accused of that, and Babaji as well, bringing people back to life.
So he had these mystical powers. You're convinced of that?
I believe that he did, and I say this at multiple levels, because as an initiate myself, I'm aware that the great mystery schools taught about seven energy bodies that we all have. Now, in Egypt, they taught nine. And that's one of the reasons Jesus had to go to Egypt for 7 years, because he had to learn how to activate these two additional bodies that allowed him to perform the incredible task of dying and then re-energizing his light body at such a level that he could materialize it at will.
Do you believe he knew he was going to get killed?
Oh, absolutely.
He did.
It was all a plan. It was a deliberate plan. In many ways, Jesus was playing out, as I said, on the world stage, this mystery drama that basically says, if you interpret it, it doesn't say, hey, you have to be long-suffering and hang on a cross and be the victim. That's not really what it's saying. I don't think that was ever his message.
Was there indeed a resurrection?
Well, that's, of course, the extra bodies that he was activating. I believe that there was. And as I say to you, this process of discovering these things, I mean, everyone comes to their understanding in their own way. And for me, it's not really been through, let us say, traditional, blind faith. I have a mind that really honors history and science and evidence and proof.
We're going to take some calls with you, Tricia, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.